of the same sentiments will be repeated in what I prepared as well. I guess just to emphasize the importance of a work like this in the current era, especially in kind of Western academia, where we kind of continuously talk about the death of the traditional working class, both as a socioeconomic phenomenon, but also as a political force. On the one hand, within the kind of like the academic tradition of new social movement, we've got what Ellen Mikeson Wood described as the retreat from class, where the kind of, you know, labor-capital conflict is no longer seen as a central force, and, you know, it's kind of a more of an academic focus on kind of the discursive construction of identity, the formation of countercultures, micro-level resistances. But also kind of in the other tradition, we've got the kind of neo-Keynesian perspective, which is kind of lamenting the decline of the industrial area, the rise of the new precariat, the decline of unions, new economic inequality, and the disappearance of the working class. The kind of importance of what Emmanuel Ness is saying is the relevance of the contemporary working class, but also its restructuring and its reconstitution. And he looks at this in terms of kind of a concrete political and historical analysis of the new international division of labour, the relocation of industry to the to the global south, but also, you know, the role of the state, the role of unions, and the role of kind of class organisation in both the making and the unmaking of the new global working class. And the relevance of this work, I think, has just been, you know, not only reinforced by statistics that show, like, you know, kind of the World Bank that says in the next few decades, 99% of the projected new world labour market will come from low and middle income developing countries. But also, a few days ago, we just saw 150 million workers in India. It was the biggest strike in history that took place. And this was workers from both formal and informal sectors that linked the demands of both formal and informal workers. And really, I think this book is a really key work in understanding the processes which have gone on in how these things are coming out, in the way that a lot of traditions in contemporary academia are unable to do at the moment. So just to kind of give a really brief overview of what we're talking about when we talk about the new kind of international division of labour. It's kind of got the two central processes which are going on are on the one hand kind of de-peasantization in developing countries. So the separation of workers from the means of production, or what developmental economist Arthur Lewis conceptualized as the creation of unlimited supplies of labour. In Latin America, for example, especially in the 80s and 90s, 90% of new employment was created in the informal sector, and that's still over half of the workforce today. Looking at the Chinese workforce of over 800 million that we've got. So this is kind of, you know, this is the composition of the new working class. But also on the other hand, you've got, coming from the north, the relocation, the kind of simplification of a lot of manual work, the relocation of production, the de-skilling of de-skilled tasks, which are moved to low-cost jobs, and what sometimes is called the new global assembly line. You've also got the kind of dominant institutions which are facilitating this process, which is the kind of rising power and global expansion of transnational corporations driven by the search for profits based on labour exploitation, specifically foreign direct investment interested in these new kind of SEZs, special economic zones, which, you know, kind of are looking for these areas specifically because they can get low wages, high surplus extraction, and they can kind of directly control the workforce and undermine the unions and the power of and undermine unions in these areas. But also the other kind of institution that you've got that Emmanuel Ness demonstrates very well, particularly, for example, in the case of South Africa, is the role of the state and the oppression of working class organisations. And weaker capacity to negotiate collective agreements with capital. And finally, kind of one thing that we see as well is what Viviane also already talked about, is a kind of this the problematic and kind of almost functional role of the historical legacy of the social compromise in unions, where kind of, you know, unions in the developing country often kind of incorporated had these kind of like bureaucratic and neo-corporatist forms that really didn't have very kind of institutional roles of labour bargaining, that were not able to deal, that had no way of dealing with the new types of conflict that would arise in the kind of contemporary moment. Like, specific example that he takes is the ACFTU in China. Okay, so one of the really good things about this work as well is that the kind of this new dynamic of the kind of this drive for cheap labour really takes advantage of the social divisions and cleavages which already exist in many of these societies. So, you know, divisions like race, caste, gender, which already are very strong. They're not created by these capitalist organisations, but they are reinforced. So the kind of one of the really good discussions I thought in it was that how, you know, the kind of racial division between workers in South Africa and the historical legacy of the caste system have really been reinforced, and also the kind of exclusion of migrant workers and the kind of rural-urban dynamic that has been reinforced by these new social SEVs. Okay, one thing I wanted to go into, just because it's kind of a particular personal interest and something that he brings up, kind of to go back into this kind of the... And I think that it's something that could be explored a lot more in the work as well, is this kind of the dynamics of rural-urban migration, specifically like the gendered division of labour, and, you know, what Emmanuel Ness brings up, which is something that comes from kind of the historical discussions in Latin American dependency theory, this idea of super-exploitation, which is the reduction of wages below the value of their labour power. So... these were kind of ideas which were actually debated a long time before this new phenomenon went on, kind of in the 1970s, with works like Oliveira and Quijano in Latin America, discussing the importance of kind of the maintenance of some kind of subsistence economy and all the dynamics of that in supporting capital accumulation in the export sector in countries in Latin America. And this also seems to be going on in a lot of the dynamics of rural-urban migration in Emmanuel Ness's work. And I thought that this could be explored a lot more. So, for example, I used to live for a couple of years in a small northern Mexican town called Zacatecas, where a lot of the local population were all migrant workers who, you know, either the wives... lived at home, the wives lived at home permanently and maintained themselves in kind of the informal economy in Zacatecas and took head of the household, while the males were all engaged in seasonal and migration work. So it's kind of that kind of interplay of the subsistence economy or the informal economy at home, but with migratory labour that's going on in these sectors. So I thought that could be something that could be brought out a bit more. Also, the kind of, and specifically, one thing he did. That is not talked about in this book really at all is the kind of, you know, gender division of labour. So, you know, as, you know, a lot of the times it's the men who are moving out and doing this migrational work, and the women taking on new household roles in the subsistence, in kind of either in the subsistence economy or, you know, kind of as independent workers. But also one thing which is really important in these new SEZs is the feminization of the workforce. You know, specifically, a lot of the time, especially, as I say, in northern Mexico, but this is also a general trend, they're looking for female workers because we are supposedly more suitable for menial tasks, we're prepared to work longer hours for lower pay, we have more nimble fingers, we have better eyesight, we're prepared to deal with things like sexual harassment that we get in these areas, which would make me a really bad worker in one of these zones. So I thought, and that is not really discussed at all. There's a brief mention of the increased feminization of unions, but it doesn't really appear in any systematic way in those case studies. So it would be interesting to find out more about that. But also... the role, you know, not only in kind of in the the way labor is structured, but also kind of in the dynamics of resistance building. So, you know, kind of, as I'm saying, like the kind of increasing the gender division of labor can be a strategy for surviving with these terrible labor conditions and kind of, you know, instead of forming workers' movements and forming resistance. But also, you know, what we're seeing in these new kind of new work, new movements of what Liliana actually describes as the new working, general working class, is a very a leading role of women. So, for example, in Bolivia's water wars, women were, you know, obviously as heads of household at the time, the most affected by the privatization of Bolivia, but also they thought they were key agents in the struggle. And the way that, that affected the organizational processes, the types of struggle that took place, the way that different kind of processes of caring, the way that the resistance was organized, was really, really, you know, affected and changed by the participation of women, and that really could be included mm-hmm. in this work. And so the second thing I wanted to kind of go, and this is something that Viviana has already discussed in much more detail, but also kind of, yes, I mean, a really good thing about this work is the key role of union building to building, you know, to building class power. We do need to build unions. And one thing that Emmanuel Ness talks about in quite a lot of detail is, you know, this how, you know, yes, FDI is looking for these, like, kind of, you know, unorganized sectors, and specifically makes use of these inappropriate union structures, which are legacies of these governments in the left wing of the past, in order to be able to use his labor. But at the same, so, you know, on the one hand, this is kind of a limitation for labor. It means that kind of resistance is not organized, it's dispersed, it's uncoordinated, and it's often spontaneous. But also, Emmanuel Ness sees this as a kind of a potential, you know, in that insofar as workers are not being represented in these traditional union structures, we're seeing the rise of new rank-and-file organizations which represent young laborers, and, you know, kind of inclusion of all different types of workers, including migrant workers, including community members. We're seeing new demands for direct democracy. We're seeing factory councils. So all these kind of, this kind of potential that there is emerging out of that kind of repressive situation. Yet I thought, I repeat the sentiment, that I think that this could be brought out a little bit more. Like, it only limits itself to saying, you know, brilliant, we've got these new relatively autonomous unions which are being built. This is an exciting schedule, but it's not. But there are further questions to be asked about this. You know, kind of, first, yes, these are still only kind of these localized and sporadic uprising a lot of the time. But also, you know, they're still linked, they're still only building unions and not building a class, in the sense that a lot of the time the struggles are only linked to wages and working conditions. And yes, it's fantastic that they're being expanded to different types of workers. But I think we also need to bring the discussion on further and talk about building real class-based movements and, you know, some form of new type of party, which, yes, of course, includes building unions, making them more democratic, making them more inclusive, but also asking more seriously the question of state power, you know, and not just seeing state power as kind of a repressive force and, or, you know, kind of the historical problem of social democratic parties and the problematic legacy that they have, but also, you know, how we can build alternative forms of party and class. I thought that in that case, a really good case study to bring in would be, you know, perhaps one of the countries from Latin America. What about Brazil, where you've got these fantastic experiences of participatory budgeting, or, you know, more interesting kind of Venezuela, where you've got the building of constituent assemblies, community councils, where you've got the organization of, you know, the working class very broadly defined, but also making decisions at the local community level, and this being having an important role in building class and state power within kind of party movements. So I'll leave it at that.
Thanks.